deeply counterproductive. It was akin to the enormous skepticism in the West regarding early reports about Nazi atrocities. It was almost impossible to conceive of such extremes of evil, and to multiply it on the scale necessary to process the information put it past the capacity of decent people. It brings to mind Leonard Cohen's poem, All There Is to Know About Adolf Eichmann. After listing the Holocaust engineer's eyes, weight, and height as normal, Cohen asked, "What did you expect? Talons? Oversized incisors? Green saliva?" Writing in 1994, communist writer Eugene Genovese explained the thinking thus. About 20 years ago, picking up on some passages in Roy Medvedev's 1971 book, Let History Judge, I wondered if Comrade Stalin had not killed more communists than were killed by all the bourgeois, imperialist, fascist, and Nazi regimes put together. It can't be true, said I. Has Comrade Medvedev taken up serious drinking? So I sat down to do some rough arithmetic. You do not have to be good at math to do that much arithmetic. Alas, Comrade Medvedev had not taken up serious drinking. Contemptuous of the idea that Stalin's government is no better than those of Mussolini or Hitler, Sinclair made clear the distinction. I have read Mussolini's speeches and know that he is one of those imperialist conquerors who care so little about truth and consistency that they can argue that their growing population must have more land to expand to, and at the same time can adopt measures to turn the women of their country into brood mares to raise more future soldiers in order that their country may be able to expand. This was in contrast to Stalin, who cared a great deal about truth and consistency and never dared dream of imperialistic conquest. Having watched the international policy of the Soviet Union from day to day as it has developed, Sinclair went on, I say that its record is pretty nearly perfect, and that upon that record it is entitled to the trust of every friend of democracy and peace. Sneering at the idea that Stalin and Hitler could ever work together, Sinclair chose to go with sarcasm. I would have thought that the shooting of Tukhachevsky and other pro-German generals might be taken to have settled that question for a long time, but to admit that would be to attribute something good to Stalin, the author said, frustrated that Stalin wasn't getting credit for all the good that he had done. The Tukhachevsky and the other generals had been tortured to confess to working with Hitler. By 1957, he and his executed colleagues would be acquitted by the Soviet Union of all charges and political rehabilitated. Sinclair's sign-off to the whole affair did not age well, to put it mildly. I give you one simple method, as certain as litmus paper in a test tube, to determine whether the Soviet Union has now become counter-revolutionary. When Hitler learns that the Soviet Union has become counter-revolutionary, he will reduce the ardor of his crusade against it. When that happens, I will admit that Stalin has sold out the workers. Sinclair was hardly alone or unique. On August 14, 1939, a group of self-described 400 leading Americans penned an open letter calling for greater unity of the anti-fascist forces and strengthening of the front against aggression through closer cooperation with the Soviet Union. It doesn't take much to make the argument that an alliance with Stalin was the right move for the United States to make after the 1941 Pearl Harbor attacks. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Yet 2 years before the Japanese assault in Hawaii, there was already a great amount of agitation for the United States to work closely with Stalin. Not in the sense of holding one's breath, but in the sense that this would be an unmitigated good. The traditional strongest argument for Americans to ally with Stalin, that Hitler was a unique evil, wasn't invoked. Not only was there no reference to Hitler's crimes, there was no argument to be made that if Hitler wasn't stopped, then millions would be killed, if that were even preventable to begin with. Indeed, Hitler's persecution of the Jewish people wasn't even mentioned by the leading Americans at all. Their only mention of anti-Semitism was to insist that the Soviet Union has made the expression of anti-Semitism or any racial animosity a criminal offense. In other words, these self-described leaders were boasting about the criminalization of speech in the USSR. On the domestic scene, the reactionaries have encouraged the fantastic falsehood that the USSR and the totalitarian states are basically alike, they said. The signatories were troubled by a recent manifesto issued by the so-called Committee for Cultural Freedom. This was the official name of the Dewey Committee, which had investigated the charges against Trotsky and all the others put on trial by Stalin and his men. The committee had concluded that it is impossible for any honest person, on the basis of records so full of contradictions and deliberate falsifications as the records of both trials, to come to any conclusion concerning their guilt or innocence of other charges or the nature of their crimes, if any. While we prefer to dwell on facts rather than personalities, the leading Americans claimed, we feel it is necessary to point out that among the signers of this manifesto are individuals who have for years had as their chief political objective the maligning of the Soviet people and their government, and it is precisely these people who are the initiators and controllers of the committee. We can't tell if Trotsky had meetings in hotels that no longer existed because the people asking questions had a history of the maligning of the Soviet people. The letter then offered 10 points how Soviet socialism differed from fascism. First and foremost was the claim that the USSR continues as always to be a consistent bulwark against war and aggression and works unceasingly for the goal of a peaceful international order. The Soviet Union has emancipated women and the family, they insisted, and has developed an advanced system of childcare. The kids were taken care of, that was for sure. Brazenly, they went on to claim that the best literature from Homer to Thomas Mann, the best thought from Aristotle to Lenin, is available to the masses of the Soviet people in a country where reading the wrong book was grounds for imprisonment and extermination. The USSR had taken part in extending scientific procedures to every field, from economics to public health, not mentioning that it was the Russian people who were being experimented upon. The ninth point might be the most explicit in its adulation of Stalin's professed ideology. The American public was told by the great minds of the day that the Soviet Union considers political dictatorship a transitional form and has shown a steadily expanding democracy in every sphere. Its epoch-making new constitution guarantees Soviet citizens universal suffrage, civil liberties, the right to employment, to leisure, to free education, to free medical care, to material security in sickness and old age, to equality of the sexes in all fields of activity, and to equality of all races and nationalities. The cast of signatories might seem oddly contemporary, especially in terms of informing, or perhaps simply forming, American political opinion. There's a professor of medicine from Stanford and a professor of English from Smith, as well as English professors from Columbia, Harvard, Wellesley, Sarah Lawrence, and NYU. Syracuse offered their chairman of the Department of Geology and Geography, and Columbia also offered their professors of industrial engineering, sociology, and of zoology, the latter certainly being in a position to advise on keeping beings in captivity. A professor of Christian ethics from Union Theological Seminary felt comfortable signing his name in good conscience, as did one from Yale University Divinity School. The poets William Carlos Williams and Langston Hughes appear alongside the head of automotive labs at MIT, as well as one of its professors of mathematics. James Thurber, Dorothy Parker's partner in SNI, and staff writer from The New Yorker makes an appearance. Williams College has two professors of government, with Vassar offering a German professor, the University of California professor of Slavic languages, and a professor of Russian language and institutions, and economics professors from the University of Chicago and Bryn Mawr. Yale Medical School, Harvard, Hunter, Columbia, NYU, and Colgate round out the list. Finally, there were editors from both The Nation and The New Republic, a ballet producer, several artists, as well as Dashiell Hammett, Granville Hicks, again, and Ernest Hemingway. It was the role of these men and women to promote ideas to the American people. As creators of public opinion, they had the power to declare an ideology as being mainstream and desirable. Indeed, they were the ones who defined what mainstream desirable discourse consisted of. The theory of the marketplace of ideas was often unable to compete with the reality of a monopoly of ideology, especially in an era where the flow of information was far more tightly controlled and technologically limited. Arendt had thoughts on how those who were partial to Stalinism operated. The sympathizers, who are to all appearances still innocuous fellow citizens in a non-totalitarian society, can hardly be called single-minded fanatics. Through them, the movements make their fantastic lies more generally acceptable, can spread their propaganda in milder, more respectable forms, until the whole atmosphere is poisoned with totalitarian elements which are hardly recognizable as such, but appear to be normal political reactions or opinions. The fellow traveler organizations surround the totalitarian movements with a mist of normality and respectability that fools the membership about the true character of the outside world as much as it does the outside world about the true character of the movement. Days after the letter was published, Hitler not only reduced the ardor of his crusade against the Soviet Union, but signed a non-aggression pact with Stalin. One may accept or reject the ideology of Hitlerism as well as any other ideological system. That is a matter of taste, Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov decreed soon after. News of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact shook the world, and knowing he had nothing to fear from Stalin, gave Hitler the freedom to invade Poland. Stalin likewise invaded from the east a little over 2 weeks later. American organizations that had advocated for involvement in Europe to fight fascism changed their names and slogans literally overnight to advocating for peace and non-intervention. For many on the left, aligning with Hitler was a bridge too far, and they permanently turned their backs on their infatuation with Stalin. As for Upton Sinclair, he never did end up admitting that Stalin had sold out the workers. Chapter 8, In Constant Terror from Morning Until Night. FDR was the first president to have his policy publicly guided by intellectuals instead of mostly politicians or other prominent citizens. His brain trust was taken from the faculties of Harvard Law and Columbia, and the term, trust meant monopoly, implied that all the great minds of the day were concentrated in his White House. As such, FDR was unusually attuned to what the creators of public opinion were saying at any given time, and he needed all the brain power he could get. As the 1930s drew to a close, the Great Depression plodded on with no end in sight. Clearly, capitalism wasn't working, and even the New Deal wasn't new enough for many leading thinkers of the day. Unemployment was at 19% in December of 1938, somewhat better than the 23.6% it had been when FDR was elected in 1932, but still nowhere near a palatable number. Worse, economic growth in 1938 had been negative for the first time in 5 years, shrinking at 3.3%. In many ways, the year 1940 was an unprecedented one in American politics, largely because FDR intended to seek a third term. No president had been elected or even nominated to a third term before, despite several attempts by some to hold on to power. Even a stroke-ridden Woodrow Wilson had to be told by his own party that his services would no longer be required in 1920. Prior to 1940, it had basically been up to the party conventions to choose the vice presidential nominee. This resulted in some truly odd pairings, such as conservative President William McKinley being matched with vigorous upstart Teddy Roosevelt in 1900. In 1932, FDR had Speaker of the House John Cactus Jack Garner foisted upon him at the convention. The prickly Texan did not at all consider himself a subordinate to the president, being instrumental in helping engineer the defeat of FDR's 1937 court packing scheme, the first major political defeat that the president had faced. By 1940, Garner had enough and declared himself a candidate for the presidency before FDR made any declaration about seeking a third term. When FDR decided that he himself was the only man for the job once again, having Garner on the 1940 ticket became a non-starter, as was the idea that choosing his running mate should be left up to the whims of the party. "This is no ordinary time," First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt told the convention. Her coded words did much to allow the attendees to cede their historic role and give FDR the man whom he had handpicked as his running mate. Secretary of Agriculture Henry Agard Wallace, a former hardcore Republican turned strong New Deal advocate. Wallace was not an entirely easy person to put over, even by FDR to his own convention. A New Ager before the term existed, DNC Chairman Jim Farley worried that people look on him as a mystic. What Farley was referring to was Wallace's fairly well-known interest in Eastern faiths like Buddhism and Zoroastrianism. More politically dangerous was what became known as the Dear Guru letters that Wallace had exchanged with Russian theosophist Nicholas Roerich, who was seen as a sort of neo-Rasputin with hypnotic sway. FDR insisted Wallace was not a mystic, but instead a philosopher, a liberal philosopher. And while there was some pushback among Democrats, President Roosevelt's hold over the party was enormous. "I won't deliver that acceptance speech until we see whom they nominate," he threatened to party insiders. That was pretty much enough to put Wallace over the top. He was nominated on the first ballot, despite the discomfort of many Democrats. The 1940 GOP nominee was businessman Wendell Willkie, who had no previous political experience and who strongly shared FDR's vision of a firmly internationalist United States ensuring a fair and just world for peoples all over the globe. It naturally followed that Willkie's first book would be entitled One World. The Roosevelt-Wallace ticket was handily elected over Willkie, 449 electoral votes to 82. A year after the election came Pearl Harbor, the first foreign assault on U.S. soil since 1812. America was now solidly and firmly involved in World War II. The vice presidency is historically a thankless political position. Woodrow Wilson's vice president Thomas Marshall was known for his wisecracks and had quipped in 1912 that once there were two brothers, one ran away to sea, the other was elected vice president, and nothing was heard of either of them again. There is something to be said for the fact that Marshall's joke is far better known today than he himself is. Henry Wallace's tenure as vice president was largely uneventful for the bulk of his term. It was still very much FDR's White House, and after Pearl Harbor, the vice president's role became even more diminished than usual. It was only by 1944, the year Roosevelt would seek a fourth term, that Henry Wallace made major waves when he authored a pamphlet entitled Our Job in the Pacific. The contents would largely become a big deal due to one of the vilest people who had ever lived, Roald Dahl. Dahl's name survives as one of the most widely read and respected children's book authors of all time, with classic after classic to his credit, like James and the Giant Peach and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. A giant of a man, the 6'5 or 6'6, accounts differ, Brit, was quite vocal throughout his life about his racist and anti-Semitic views. Claims that Hitler didn't just pick on them for no reason paled in comparison to his personal behavior. Dahl would eventually end up marrying actress Patricia Neal, who had played the romantic interest and off-screen lover, to star Gary Cooper in the film adaptation of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. The movie's sexual tension had culminated in Neal's rape by engraved invitation by Cooper. Dahl acted similarly after his wife suffered a series of 3 strokes in rapid succession, temporarily putting her into a coma and causing newspapers to prematurely run her obituary. Her recovery process was nightmarish. We were sleeping together, but sex hadn't entered my mind. So when his hand touched me, I was stunned. I did not tell him he couldn't do that, but I hoped he would hear my silent signal. Half my body was paralyzed and the other half rigid with tension. I closed my eyes and did not move. I did not scream. I wanted to. It was agony. Agony. In 1944, however, Dahl's greatest claim to fame was having been shot down and badly burned during a Royal Air Force pilot mission over Greece. He was also a British Secret Service agent assigned to Washington, and it was in that capacity that he uncovered information that would help to torpedo Wallace's career. As Wallace biographer John C. Culver recounts, Dahl attended a social gathering at the Washington home of the Texas newspaper publisher Charles Marsh. There, he saw Marsh and Wallace reviewing the manuscript of Our Job in the Pacific. After Wallace left, Marsh showed the manuscript to Dahl. The agent took the manuscript downstairs where he said he could read it in privacy. Instead, he called a contact at British Security Coordination and told him to come quickly to Marsh's house. I handed the draft through the car window and told him he must be back with it in 15 minutes, Dahl recalled. The man buzzed off to the BSC Washington offices and duly returned the manuscript to me on the dot. In the pamphlet, Wallace advocated the decolonization of East Asia, something entirely at odds with the British perspective at the time, especially the perspective of Prime Minister Winston Churchill. You know, Churchill is likely to ask the president to get a new vice president, Dahl correctly predicted. Churchill blew his top, and though the relationship between him and FDR was a complex and often difficult one, there's little doubt the British animus toward Wallace affected the president's perspective. The Brits were not alone. After 4 years in office, Wallace had acquired a reputation of being too cozy with the radical left. Though clearly an ideological progressive, many Democrats remembered that Wallace had been loyal Republican not that long ago, in a period where men like the Senators Lafoyette represented the vibrant left-wing tradition within the GOP. These concerns were especially important for White House insiders who could see firsthand that President Roosevelt was on his last legs, making the question of his possible successor one of utmost importance. 3 things happened on July 11, 1944. First, FDR officially announced that he would be seeking a 4th term as president. Second, FDR decided to dump Wallace from the ticket. Third, he met with Wallace to strategize about the forthcoming campaign. Just as with Upton Sinclair, Wallace left the meeting certain that FDR would shortly be endorsing him. 10 days later, and with FDR's blessing, Democratic Party Chairman Robert Hannigan and other party insiders used all the power at their disposal to make sure that Henry Wallace was removed from the ticket and Senator Harry S. Truman nominated as the vice presidential candidate instead. The FDR-Truman ticket won another landslide, 36 out of the 48 states, while regaining 22 seats in the House after the 1942 midterms had reduced the Democrats' margin to a handful. 5 weeks after the inauguration, FDR was posing for an artist when he either declared, "I have a terrific pain in the back of my head," or "I have a terrific headache," before dying from a cerebral hemorrhage. Truman had been drinking with Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn when the call came for him to go to the White House immediately. There, he met the First Lady and was told the news. Concerned, he asked Eleanor Roosevelt if there was anything he could do for her. "Is there anything we can do for you?" she replied. "You are the one in trouble now." A year after he would have been inaugurated as president, Henry Wallace published a book entitled Soviet Asia Mission about his trip abroad as vice president. In it, Wallace discussed touring Siberia and the Far East and his impression of the people and places that he saw. While FDR was administrating concentration camps for Japanese Americans at home, his vice president had been touring one in the Soviet Union and offering his approval of the conditions that the prisoners faced. There are very few loanwords that English speakers have borrowed from the Russian language. Robot is often considered to be one of these, even though the origin is Czech. Bistro is another, the allegation being that Russian customers would yell "bistro, bistro," quickly, quickly, at French waitstaff in attempts to get them to hurry. But this seems to be more of a good story than good etymology. But there is one word in English whose Russian origin is not in dispute: gulag. The term's Russian origin is itself an acronym for Glavne Upravlenie Lagery, which translates to Chief Administration of the Camps. Lyons summed up the intellectual's mindset regarding Russian oppression quite succinctly. "To a good many onlookers, the Russian Revolution is a great experiment in which sociological results to be attained justify a colossal human investment. The 160 million inhabitants are the raw material of the experiment, and a formula for economic perfection is its objective. The application of pressure here and there, as required by the research experts, the exiling or physical extinction of a portion of the population, it's all part of the experimental process. Those who are squeamish are just white-livered sentimentalists in a class with vegetarians and anti-vivisectionists. It is the guinea pig theory of revolution. Of course the animals squeal, but why should superior people be bothered about the noise? When you peer down from above, watching objectively, the Russians look quite small. French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre was not unique, though more explicit in his views, writing that, as we were not members of the party, it was not our duty to write about Soviet labor camps, and that, I find these camps intolerable, but I find equally intolerable the use made of them every day in the bourgeois press. Theodore Dreiser was one of the great American novelists, still remembered for seminal works of naturalism such as Sister Carrie and Jenny Gerhardt. His sentiments in a 1933 missive mirrored Sartre's. I would answer your question about those Russian prisoners at once, except that I'm so much interested in the present difficulties in Russia and in Russia's general fate that I'm not prepared, without very